This is Mark Seltzer.
And Jessica Piclo.
We ought to take a look at the recent changes, recent events in the Senate healthcare debate. I thought I'd get into that by just doing a quick backgrounder, noting that we're in the Senate now because the House has already passed its version of healthcare reform. As you may remember, the House version expands cover to the uninsured. It does so including a public option, which has been very controversial, and that's certainly one of the sticking points in the Senate. The House legislation did include restrictions on insurance. For example, there would not be pre-existing condition exclusions. Also, an attempt to further restrict some abortion funding. I don't know if you want to...
Sure, yeah. It's called the STUPAC Amendment, and it's gotten quite a bit of press and attention, and rightly so. And what it does is a couple things. First, maybe a little quick summary. Currently, as it stands, we have what are known as the Hyde Amendments. And the Hyde Amendments prohibit federal dollars in any way, shape, or form for going to fund abortion-related services. And that is a broad umbrella term that covers a lot more than what our public understanding is of just of an abortion. So the STUPAC Amendment says the following, that if insurers offer a plan that covers abortion services, that plan cannot be part of an exchange or the pooling that's geared towards small business and self-insureds. So even if a woman wants to use her own private money to buy private insurance on her own, not at all connected with publicly funded insurance options, those plans are prohibited from existing within this public-private exchange. What that means is, as a practical matter, is that abortion services won't be covered because insurance is a game of and a business of creating uniformity. So they are not going to have these multi-layered plans if they know that one exists and it will take them out of the biggest pool of possible insureds. So that's the reality. So women can't use private dollars towards purchasing private policies that would cover abortion-related services.
Right. Okay. So that's great. And it's certainly a significant step. And it's aroused a lot of controversy and a lot of reaction. A bit of a surprise under the leadership of House Majority Leader Pelosi that something like that came into the final version of the bill. I think that in the Senate, they've already had a vote to try to include, I think it was Ben Nelson's amendment, to try to include something similar in the Senate legislation, and that failed. So we are, in the end, going to have two different competing ideas, two different pieces of legislation that the conference committee will have to reconcile. But I think that brings us up to the Senate now. We can talk about what is in the Senate legislation and where we are going forward with that.
Right. And so the Senate legislation every day looks a lot different than the House legislation so far. And this the conference committee process is going to be fascinating, in my opinion.
Yeah.
As you already mentioned, the Senator Ben Nelson, a Democrat out of Nebraska, introduced an almost identical measure to the STUPAC Amendment, and that failed. The Democrats have taken the senators, and mostly led by the Democrats, have taken a slightly different approach to this idea of the uninsured, and one of the approaches is to decrease the eligibility age for Medicare. That is one of the proposals that is out there.
Right. I think they're talking about starting Medicare eligibility at 55 instead of 65. So, of course, that's a huge increase in the number of people that would be participating. It would be interesting because, of course, the older the population is, the more likelihood that they will use medical services. So that's where the costs are going to be. And it will be interesting that the bill for Medicare would, of course, go up and have to be covered. And yet, I guess the idea was that this is preferable to a public option. So there's sort of a trade-off here in terms of how they're looking at it. I think it's interesting that the Senate has gone its own way. I know they're dealing politically with a different idea that they've got to reach cloture. They've got to get 60 votes together in order to cut off debate and come up with a final bill. And they've got about 55 strong votes for Democratic proposals. And then between the Blue Dog Democrats, more conservative Democrats, the couple of independents, and the moderate Republicans, they've got another five or so to people that they can try to get to join on to the general agenda for reform. And so it's created really interesting conflicts. For one thing, that a number of those more conservative Democrats, independents, have said that they would not accept a public option. And that's shifted. It's been a battle for days now, but it's shifted the debate. And what they're talking about is insuring the uninsured through a public-private program where there'd be actually a private insurance company or insurance companies that would be running insurance for the uninsured, but it would be supervised by the federal government, the same insurance overseer that looks at the federal employee programs.
You know, you mentioned a little bit about the politics going on in the Senate in terms of trying to craft its own piece of legislation. And I think even though there's been a lot of outcry about what is a backing away and probably a loss altogether of a public option, I think this lowering the age of eligibility for Medicare is a brilliant and very savvy political move, because the Republicans and conservative Democrats and independents have already gone on record saying we want to protect Medicare. That's the position that they took. Ironically enough, the Republicans were positioning themselves as staunch defenders of a public insurance program. But by suggesting that we lower that age limit to eligibility, it's going to be very hard for them to say they don't support that.
Yes. And I think, you know, also one of the objections has been they don't want to start a new bureaucracy. They don't want to set up a whole new program. And I think that's come not only from the Republicans, but it's come from some Democrats as well. The idea that the public option was going to involve inventing a new insurance program for the people who have been uninsured. And here what we're saying is we've already got a program. It already works for the 65 and older part of the population. Mm-hmm. And we're simply including more people in what is a very well-managed and very popular health program.
And one of the reasons I think you don't hear as much outcry from the progressives on this is we've been typically rallying for a single-payer option, which is essentially Medicare for everyone. And lowering the age gets us closer to that. If you bring it down once, there's no reason why you can't bring it down again, so that in 7-10 years' time, you go from eligibility at 55 to eligibility at 45. And so I think those rallying in the progressive side of things have looked at this and said, while it's not perfect, to paraphrase our president, we can't let perfect be the enemy of good on this. And expanding eligibility in Medicare actually gets us closer to our original stated goal, which is single-payer, affordable insurance coverage for everybody.
Yes, and I haven't literally heard President Obama speak on this yet, but it does seem to have some advantages in cost cutting. I mean, I think they've sent this proposal to the Congressional Budget Office to get it scored, to get back numbers as to whether it increases, decreases, and by how much in terms of the federal budget. But allowing people to be in one program, such as Medicare, does mean that when you implement a change, it can be very effective, very efficient. You know, it's mm-hmm. not... This is not money that is being used up in insurance paperwork and forms. The management costs for Medicare are very small. And when a health study, for example, determines that a certain type of care or a certain type of drug is more effective than another or more cost-effective than another, that can be implemented among millions and millions of people quite simply. And so there are some possible advantages.
Exactly. And one of the things we also haven't heard a lot about, which I think we will start to if there is pushback on this Medicare expansion, is the fact that we also have a very well-functioning policing mechanism in place. The Department of Justice already attacks healthcare fraud vigorously, and even more so in the recent months. And Attorney General Holder and others have said that Medicare fraud and healthcare abuse in that regard is a high priority. So considering the anti-regulatory and anti-enforcement stance that the previous administration took, I think it is a simpler argument to say we already know how to curtail possible abuses, because that's been the critique of Medicare, is that there is the possibility for fraud left, right, and center.
Yeah.
But there's possibility for fraud in the private market. We see that all the time. Yeah. And what we've learned in this process is that Medicare does run at about, you know, a 10 to 12% higher efficiency rating than the private market does.
There are 11 freshman Democratic senators who have been working on their own proposals for healthcare amendments. And I just read through, and one of the things they take on, you know, the topic and trying to be efficient, trying to cut waste, they also talk about using Medicare efficiencies and Medicare values to help streamline the private system as well. Because, of course, many Americans are paying for their insurance privately, or their employer is paying for their insurance and they're co-paying on premiums or care. And it looks like there are going to be some, I don't know whether this amendment will succeed or not, but there's going to be some push to force the private insurance marketplace to become more efficient, more effective for the remaining, talking about the remaining mm-hmm. population. And they're partly saying they can look to Medicare as a model and look to what can be gained by showing, comparing the value that one gets in Medicare service delivery with the value that you get from your private insurance company, giving people more of the ability to choose and compare what they're getting for their money.
Well, it's the adage that a rising tide lifts all boats, that if you create a model that works well, the others have to follow, because nobody will stand for the kinds of inefficiencies that would become that much more apparent if this measure passes as it stands.
That's right. Okay. So I think that's great. I think the next thing to look for is how this stands in the Senate, whether this is the bill going forward or whether it gets adjusted further before the Senate finally takes a vote.
Well, I expect some more tinkering. I read a report this morning that some of the patient advocacy groups are concerned because there has already been a dilution down of the protections that were originally in place to prohibit insurers from placing dollar caps on the amount of care that goes towards a particular condition. So the American Cancer Society, for example, today came out and said they are upset by this situation and they're not quite certain how they're going to advise and lobby their members in terms of support. So one thing is that we are witnessing is a fantastic exercise and lesson in how legislation gets passed.
Right. And that brings us back to the, for example, in the House, I believe there were no caps. That was part of the restrictions on insurance companies that came in the House legislation. So when you're saying it's been weakened in the Senate, then this could very well, if it stays the way it is, could very well go to the conference committee, go to Senator Reid and Representative Pelosi and their team, who are going to craft together one piece of legislation from two mm-hmm. and, you know, have control over what will eventually be voted on as final
right.
legislation.
Right. So I suspect we'll see some horse trading, because we do have some of these enormous gulfs that Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid are going to have to bridge. Abortion being one of them, the lack of a public option being another, although I did hear that Nancy Pelosi did go on record saying she supports the Medicare expansion. So that, I think, is a signal to the Senate that she is willing to talk. She stopped short of actually endorsing any particular provisions in the Senate bill, but just said that sounded like a positive development. And how they are able to do that remains a mystery to me, to be quite honest. We are far from a finished piece of legislation.
I wonder how the conservatives will react to the idea of eliminating the public option, but using these two other trade-offs, the mm-hmm. use of the public-private plan for the uninsured and the expansion of Medicare. Mm-hmm. I'm curious. I certainly haven't seen a reaction yet.
I haven't seen a reaction yet either, but I think that it is a difficult position to be in as a conservative to not at least back in part some of these suggestions, because at that point you have really literally offered nothing in terms of alternative policy. Both of these provisions are not ideal, but as you mentioned earlier, they are targeted at hitting the stated and specified concerns that the Republicans and conservative Democrats came out in early against some of the House proposals. So, for example, when you are on the House or Senate floor and you are rallying against the fact that any expansion of a public option is going to impact Medicare and Medicaid services, and we can't let that happen, and you are met with the response of, okay, so we'll take that off the table, and since you like Medicare so much, we're just going to make that more available. Then how do you say no to that? No, I don't want more people to be covered. I mean, aside from the fact that there is this concern that you have ballooning costs, but we've seen that at least starting in the conversation to get addressed. So I think the conservatives at the end of the day are in a sticky position. The fact that that the Democrats are insisting on keeping them involved throughout the process is still boggling my mind a little bit, but I will give them the benefit of the doubt that they've been doing their job longer than I certainly have. So they probably know more of what they're doing than I do right now.
I do think the Republicans are going to maintain their challenge to the idea of the government spending money. I mean, even though healthcare has been widely in the public accepted as a crucial part of modern life that we want everyone to be able to afford, to be able to have, they seem to have really drawn the line and said, well, they're not going to spend on it. They want it to be private. So I don't know that there's going to be an embrace of this idea of expanding Medicare. But I think it's interesting because the Republicans have essentially taken the position they're going to oppose everything that Obama puts forward, everything that is contained in a Democratic reform proposal. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I think that part of what they're betting is that when it finally comes down to a vote and the whatever the package is that is ratified and turned into law, and I do believe that there will be a successful, you know, reform measure that will get through the House, the Senate, and get to the president's desk, that at that point, Republicans can simply complain against the parts of it that they don't like and say that they're for the parts of it that they do like. And in fact, a year later, when some things are successful and the public is very happy with some measures and other things the public has doubts about or concerns about, there's nothing to stop the Republicans from saying that was what we were thinking all along. We didn't like the parts that didn't work, and otherwise we were all for reform. So
just in time for 2010.
Exactly. Unfortunately, you know, I think that while they appear to be taking an extreme position against it this time, they will later on change their, you know, their tone to speak differently about the reform that gets through.
Well, it's certainly a fascinating process and good for the American public because it's an issue that they're engaged in. And we haven't had one of those for a while in terms of also witnessing Congress doing its job. People are learning or relearning in some instances how a bill becomes a law.
Yes, absolutely. And there's a great deal of information available through the internet, the blogs, the traditional media. Everything is being covered. And I, you know, compare this with what happened when legislation was being pushed through for Medicare, and Lyndon Johnson was negotiating everything through his office. So the leadership negotiating, but none of that information really getting out to the public. It's a far different world today with the advances in electronic media.
And I think it's a far different world in more recent history in terms of how Congress is doing its job. If you look at an example like the Patriot Act, for example, a bill that a lot of Democrats probably would not support, but just went through. And I think the availability of things like Twitter and blogs and other types of social media has allowed a level of democratic participation across the board that is unprecedented and exciting, in my opinion.
Yeah, oh, I agree with you. And it's so interesting. We think about Twitter. I mean, I've been thinking about Twitter in terms of the protests in Iran and the fact that protesters were using Twitter to get out video, to get out messages about what was going on. And we were looking and saying from the West, look what something like Twitter or generally electronic media is doing for their democratic movement. Mm-hmm. And maybe not seeing that, of course, we don't have the same problems that they do in Iran, but seeing how it is being used to transform our democracy as well. These new media opportunities.
Absolutely. And with the White House launching and initiating a sort of new government or new openness initiative in government, we may see some more. I mean, transparency and daylight is the ultimate in disinfectant. So I am hopeful, despite all of the challenges, and there are plenty that we have as a nation right now. It's good to see people as engaged, even if it is a little loud and bossy. But democracy isn't pretty.
No.
I think Ben Franklin was the first to point that out.
Well, you know, that's right. And I was also thinking, you know, you mentioned the openness in government program, and also, you know, C-SPAN up to three different channels covering so many different aspects of what's going on in Washington, that it's interesting because when you look at either the whitehouse.gov or C-SPAN, the different sources of information, and of course, there are many now with the Congressional Watch, different groups. When you look at the comments, there are comments coming from all over the world. So mm-hmm. people all over the world are following what's going on in government. And they're involved, they're participating, they're giving their feedback. Now, they may be Americans abroad, or they may just be other people that are interested, but there is a tremendous opportunity for learning, for participation, and for, you know, development of these muscles of democracy, these abilities of democracy, even in people in other parts of the world.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, should we call that a day?
Let's call it a day. That's plenty for folks to chew on and think about, and a good place for us to think about what we'll cover next time.
Okay, sounds great. Thanks, Jessica.